Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. This evening is Thursday, July 22nd, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight, very important events to cover in money and markets, your questions and ask Catherine, then a profound discussion with about new technology that truly is revolutionizing our world with author and activist Dr. Nick Begich. We're going to go an extra 15 minutes tonight because this conversation is so important. If you can't stay with us, we'll have the MP3 posted, and you can always listen to it after tomorrow evening. Our movie this week was Dr. Begich's most recent video recording on HARP. If you have not had a chance to see it, I encourage you to do so. It's posted in the blog post. One note, last week we covered identity theft with Bob Sullivan, a great conversation. The MP3s in the archive. We also posted a link next to the MP3, which a list of sort of the simple, most important actions you can take to protect yourself against identity theft, or if that doesn't work, what you can do to deal with it quickly and well. It's just a 2-page printout. It's a great list of some simple and important things you can do, and I recommend you take a look at it if you didn't have a chance to join us. Our theme this evening is UGG, which is the word I used when I finished reading almost 2,000 pages of the Frank.Wallstreet Reform and Protection Act. We're working on a written Solari report, which we'll have in the beginning of August. This is a long act, over 1,600-plus sections. The UGG is the sound of the millions of hours of productive people's time that's going to be stolen or wasted. More about this in money and markets, but I have to quote Lao Tzu, who once said, "The more restrictions and prohibitions there are, the poorer the people become. The more skill artisans require, the more bizarre their products are. The more precisely laws are articulated, the more thieves and outlaws increase." The big news this week, I have to say, more important than the Frank.Wallstreet Reform and Protection Act, is the unemployment benefits renewed. If anything, this is an example of the extent to which there were real concerns about what the political implications would be and what the economic implications would be, particularly the housing market, if those benefits weren't passed. Unemployment is quite significant, not just people who are unemployed, but people whose hours or income have been cut back. The benefits are coming out retroactive. Watch that give a little bit of support to both the housing markets and the consumers market. My guess is if they hadn't approved these, you were looking at a very politically tense summer with the Congress headed home for campaigning for the fall elections. Again, the central bank and Treasury want a squeeze and a slow burn, not a collapse or violence. So it's a very important indicator of where the economy is and how many people are really hurting. Well, the Frank.Wallstreet Financial Reform Bill went to the president. It is signed. I've now had a chance to review the bill summaries in detail, reviewed the bill, and again, we are writing a piece. Look for that in the next 2 weeks. The legislation does not address the real problem. The real problem, in a nutshell, is that the financial system is extracting wealth from the real economy instead of serving the real economy and helping the real economy build wealth. I once told you that my nickname for the Patriot Act was the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act, and that process continues here with a few sort of positive lights. There's more centralization, more power to the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government. If you ask me who engineered the bubble, it was both Wall Street and the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government, but clearly, because of the powers and authorities they have, the federal government was in the lead. So you're basically engineering more power and fairly broad, somewhat arbitrary and capricious rules, which is the strongest kind of power to have in any kind of economy. Up to the very people who engineered the last, whether you want to call it financial crisis or financial coup d'etat. One of the reasons we had such a big bubble is because so many of the insider private players have access to the federal credit, whether it's FDIC insurance, federal credit behind the mortgage markets in the form of various kinds of insurance or securitization through Freddie and Fannie. And now with $12 trillion of bailouts. And part of the problem is if one group of players has access to the federal credit and other group of players called entrepreneurs don't, you know, you get these kind of bubbles led by the guys who do. And it's very simple. If you really want to fix the problem, then you want to address the extent to which the federal credit has run out of control. And in fact, this law doesn't even touch it. We know that the federal government since 1995 has failed to comply with the laws related to financial management, included audited financial statements. We know there's $4 trillion missing that hasn't been accounted of from. We also know that that the various efforts to produce audited financial statements included implementing lots of new financial systems. It was announced last week, the week before, that the federal government was canceling some of those efforts. So in the spirit of physician, heal thyself, there's no effort to address the extent to which the federal credit is really outside of the law and functioning that way. The bill does not reinstate Glass-Steagall, the change in the late 90s that had so much to do with the bubble really running away. And to our shock and amazement, we get a report this week from Morgan Stanley's chief financial officer indicating that, in fact, thanks to some of the provisions in the bill, they may take their interest rate derivatives and foreign exchange trading units out of their broker-dealer and move them into their bank holding company, which is quite astonishing. So things seem to be going in the opposite direction. I discussed last week the provisions related to foreign investment. In my truly appear to be capital controls, it's going to drive out innovation. It's going to drive out reasonable, absolutely reasonable access to foreign financial products. There are a lot of operational surprises, not just to the little guys, but the big guys. I mentioned last week the corporations who use derivatives for legitimate hedging are now in the position of having to post collateral. We've seen suddenly the rating agencies tell people they can't put the bond ratings on bond prospectuses, and the SEC announcing today, surprise announcement, that certain offerings are relieved of having to have the ratings on them, conflicts in the way the law is going to be applied versus current regulation. So part of the challenge is this entire structure leaves a great deal up in the air. We've got 533 regulations to be promulgated and 60 reports to be made. So you have people throughout the economy literally have to say, I don't know, I'll have to wait to see the proposed regs and then the final regs. So it's a lot of the economy to freeze up. A couple of bright spots. One, of course, is Elizabeth Warren's work on consumer. There's a real lobbying effort to get her put as the head of the new consumer agency, which is inside the Fed. The banks apparently are opposing it, the unions for it. And so, it always matters no matter how bad things are, the quality of the people you have inside. So it will be a positive step if Warren gets put in that position. But watch her engage in some fireworks over the next 2 years while she tries to get something done. Gary Gensler over at the Commodities Future Trade Commission, one of the bright spots is we really do need greater disclosure, transparency, standardization, and regulation on derivatives. It's hard to do that without global coordination. The bill authorizes the CFTC and Gensler to do that. Let's hope he stays to see that job done. The accredited investor qualifications were not raised. That was one of my great fears. Kit Bond, of Senator from Missouri, got that stopped, and now it's the GAO is going to do a study, and let's hope that gets beaten back. But with 533 regs to work out the details on this, what we're seeing is a lobbyist full employment act, and this is going to go on for some time. Again, a report due in about 2 weeks, so stay tuned. The stock market, we continue to watch record redemptions in the domestic mutual funds. There's real concern about where the U.S. stock markets are going. The most closely watched stock, BP, of course, everybody's waiting and praying that the relief wells work. That's going to, we don't know, and it's going to take more time as Gulf storms approach the Gulf. In the bond market, real concern, same as the stock market, about deflation coming from drops in income. drops in labor prices, lots of indications that the economy is slowing down, and of course now we have the Federal Reserve and the foreign central banks indicating they're not going to have big stimulus packages to help the consumer. One of the questions, of course, is dollar versus euro, and the reality is everybody's got debt problems. It's everywhere. We're continuing to see more of the pain in the as the state and local cutbacks continue. Probably the most painful line this week, aren't you glad you're not the mayor of Bell, which is a city of 38,000, about 10 miles southeast of Los Angeles. It was discovered today that the city manager earns an annual salary of almost $800,000. You can imagine the fury in that city. Joe Mizak is one of my favorite reporters in the municipal area. We have requested that he join us on the Solari report, and he had to go back to central headquarters at Bloomberg and has since come back and said no, he cannot do it. So I know some of you have been looking for our conversation on the municipal market. If you have people in mind, I'm going to be doing a search for someone other than Joe, so let me know. Housing market, more pain. Unfortunately, after the president signed the financial reform bill, he indicated his next area of reform is going to be the housing finance system. I just want to groan. Part of the problem is the FHA has recently issued an independent actuarial study that shows that the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund is now below its statutorily mandated threshold. And, of course, Fannie and Freddie are on life support thanks to the U.S. Treasury. In the media, we had the Washington Post come out with a major investigative piece called Top Secret America. It has everybody who's been covering the black budget laughing, kind of where have they been. I was on Coast to Coast last night, and George Norrie said, oh, they're trying to compete with Coast to Coast. I had to laugh. One of the reasons it's so funny is the Washington Post is one of the newspapers that was so instrumental in helping a lot of transparency get stopped. They were instrumental in stopping the Community Wizard software tool and place-based disclosure. It's a long, complicated story, including Katie Graham and me being snubbed by Katie at a cocktail party at her house. But suffice it to say, you know, you kind of feel like saying to the Washington Post, well, where have you been for the last 30 years? So quite a week, and stay tuned. We're going to have a major talk with Franklin Sanders in the Precious Metals Market Report in August about rebuilding local economies, because where you're really starting to see the tension grow to unbearable lengths and people start to really move politically is at the local level where I am, a real battle over the sheriff's race and whether we're going to have the rule of law in Hardeman County and real fights over food freedom and food regulation, because that's one of the areas where local entrepreneurs can really make an enormous difference. But if the federal government just keeps passing laws making it uneconomic for them to function or survive, we've got a real problem. Again, GNP is a function of farm income, particularly small farm income, and as Franklin says, the things that people take out of the earth. So the part of this regulatory issue is who's going to control the real economy, and is the real economy going to be run in a way that would produce wealth? Okay, ask Catherine. We've got some great questions, and I'm going to focus on some of the more technical ones. Question number one, the small company I work for has decided to terminate its 401k plan in a month. What factors would you consider in helping you decide which distribution, cash, direct rollover, or split, assuming between the two, would you choose? The decision as to whether to keep your money in a tax-managed plan or to move it out is very, very unique. Some of the considerations are your other assets, your age, but the most important assumption is your concern regarding what changes in laws in the future could do to a self-directed IRA and what that does to the economics versus the cost of paying taxes and penalties on what you take out. and paying taxes on income gains over time. As I've said before, I don't have an IRA, and I don't intend to ever have one. If you go to the blog and do a search for IRA and 401k, you can find all the history and stories and a lot of great articles on these topics. I do have companies, and including a company that has tax loss carryforwards as a result of the money that I invested in litigation starting Soleri, so I have other ways to shelter. But again, the key decision and assumption you're going to make in deciding is going to come down to a political estimation about the future, and that's why it's, at the end of the day, it's something you've got to decide for yourself. If you want to do the pro forma numbers on it, it's really the increased taxes and penalties versus your estimate of what the losses that could come about by increased controls or changes in the law. I just want to also note I have a conflict of interest on this topic because at Soleri Silver and Gold, we do sell precious metals into IRAs. Obviously, we sell precious metals outside of IRAs as well. And again, I encourage you to do a search on the blog and read the back posts. Second question, I wanted to know if I had seen the article at Newman's Master about the, it referred to it as the 1099 gold tax proposal. There was an article, or several articles in the last week and a half regarding the impact of the change in the Health Care Act regarding 1099s by business. The articles make it sound as though this is specifically targeted to people who are purchasing precious metals from customers. It describes the fact that under the new Health Care Act, that a precious metals dealer who purchases $600 more or more of coins needs to give a 1099 to the person they purchased the coins from. If the law is implemented as currently drafted, that's the case. We wrote a commentary on this part of the Health Care Act, which you can find at the blog. It's dated May 7th, 2010, and it's called A Soleri Report, The Biggest 2010 Health Care Act Change You Never Heard About. Now, here's what's important to understand about this provision. It's not targeted at precious metals dealers whatsoever. The provision applies to all businesses for everything. Any business that pays $600 or more for anything has to give a 1099. This is an unimaginable blizzard of paperwork, and it's if it goes to in effect as drafted, it's going to be unbelievably burdensome, particularly to small business. I have a hard time believing it'll get implemented as it's currently drafted. It's subject to proposed regulations and regulations. That process is going to go on this year and next. The soonest it would take effect is 2012. But if you're interested, I would encourage you to read it. But this is a very much an emergent story and has a long way to go through the regulatory process. But needless to say, if that provision goes into effect, it's going to be pretty frightening. Another question, new rules on reporting foreign financial assets. Can Catherine schedule a qualified speaker such as a tax attorney or CPA, since part of this financial strategy appears to involve holding foreign assets such as gold money? We need to keep alert to changes in required filings, deadlines, and penalties. The foreign bank and financial account, known as FBAR, requires filings for foreign financial accounts. That started a while ago. We've had a series of articles. Our latest article, which includes a description of the proposed regulations, is up at the blog. It's dated June 6, 2010, and it's very detailed. It gives you immediate access to a copy of the form, and if you go through that and our prior links, you'll know everything and more you wanted to know about FBAR. Now, the forms are due on June 30th, and I will schedule someone next, probably in the beginning of May, so we talk about it and you have plenty of time to do your FBAR forms. I do want to stress that it's very important, whatever we think or say, whatever you read in the articles, that your tax preparer, if you have someone else prepare your taxes, is the ultimate authority on the specifics of how you comply. So we always defer to tax preparers. One of the other questions is gold money a reportable account? For reasons explained in the last blog post, I believe yes. Again, I defer to your tax preparer. There are many other people who disagree with my interpretation on that. So it's not free from doubt, and reasonable people can take a very different position. So that's it for Ask Catherine. Keep the great questions coming, and I'll try and make sure they all get answered. But I want to move to our interview this evening. And you know, every week I have a hero of the week, and so this week, believe it or not, I'm going to do something I've never done. Our hero of the week is the person we're interviewing, Dr. Nick Begich. I won't go into his extensive background. His bio is linked up in the blog post. He's an author. He's an activist. He's the founder of Earth Pulse Press. His many books are extraordinary. I have them all. I've read them all. I strongly recommend them. He's been very generous with producing numerous videos, including on the topic we're talking about tonight. You can find them easily through his website and on the web, articles as well. I sat down last night, and this is the reason I describe him as my hero of the week. I sat down last Saturday, and I said, you know, before we do this Solari report, I'm going to review all the books and articles and watch three or four of the videos. Well, this was sort of a 10 or 12-hour process. And by the time I was over, I said, how does this man stay so healthy and so calm? It's one thing to bring incredible intellectual accomplishments to these topics and to make them freely available, but to do it with a sense of humor and a balanced and intelligent perspective and stay absolutely fit and healthy on top of it, to me, is quite an accomplishment. So, Dr. Begich, are you with us?
I am indeed, and thank you for those very kind words, and I certainly appreciate it. You know, that it is true, though. You know, I think the intensity of some of the topics, you really have to have at least a little bit of a sense of humor, or I think it would devour you.
So I try
to maintain that.
You live in one of the most beautiful places in the world, in Alaska.
Right.
So I had this, as I was watching all these different videos, I said, you know, he must just disappear into the wilderness, you know, and talk to the trees.
Well, actually, I was just there. It was 2 days in and 2 days out, really bushwhacking it through the wilderness and with a friend of mine to a property that we have. It's with some partners, about 800 acres out in the Wrangell St. Elias Mountains.
Actually
one of the big historic copper districts of our state. It's a pretty remarkable area historically and aesthetically.
Well, maybe that's how you keep your perspective. Well, we're talking tonight about HAARP, and why don't we start with the obvious. What in the world is HAARP?
Well, it's the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. It was started in the 90s, in the early 90s, as a joint effort of the Air Force and Navy in conjunction with the Geophysical Institute, which is part of the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and later got transitioned over to DARPA, but essentially is a very large field of antennas, a phased array is what it's referred to as, and it creates a focused radio frequency energy that can be used for manipulating both environmental factors and other energetic factors of the planet. It's pretty remarkable instrument, but it's been, you know, under various phases of development here now for, the better part of 16, 17 years.
And who owns the technology?
Well, originally, interestingly enough, it was owned by Atlantic Richfield's subsidiary, Arco Power Technologies, Inc., which later sold it, and just for reference, Arco was at that time one of the biggest oil and gas companies, you know, in the world, and was one of the biggest participants in the Prudhoe Bay fields. And so they then sold that subsidiary, which was originally organized by a gentleman, Dr. Ben Eastland, who we maybe talk about a little bit later in this program. But the bottom line was it went from them to E-Systems and then later to Raytheon, and Raytheon absorbed this subsidiary and the patents that they controlled. And Raytheon, interestingly enough, when HAARP was first being contemplated, it was put out for a bid on request for proposals, and Raytheon was one of the losing bidders to this company owned by the subsidiary owned by ARCO, which is essentially a brand new company, had 31 employees at the time, no history of government contracting, reported $5 million in annual sales, and their first major contract was $31 million to develop the prototypical models for HAARP.
And that must have been because they had the patent.
Absolutely. It was a proprietary knowledge that drove that award, because under federal procurement regulations, if you have proprietary knowledge such as patents, then you have the ability essentially to no bid or to compete in a much different way than other more established companies.
When we were talking with Clifford Carnicom about the Global Spraying Program and HAARP came up, I posted a link to the patent on the blog, and I just moved it under the related reading in the blog post about this interview, just in case anybody wants to quickly access it.
Right, and there's actually a cluster of patents. There were 9 involved in total, and each of them representing a certain component of the technology. But this technology wasn't just centered on HAARP. It really builds on earlier knowledge and understandings of the ionosphere and sort of the geophysics of the planet. This instrument is unique in the ability of, first of all, its effective radiative power, the amount of energy that it can create, and then secondly, the ability to move that energy in very specific ways to create a number of applications in weapons-related technologies.
And can you explain what the ionosphere is?
Sure. It's a layer that begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, extending out for about 600 miles, and it's an energetic layer. It actually protects the planet from incoming particle streams and radiation that would make life impossible. So think of it as an electrical filter, if you will, and also a very charged up area. And so it's more of a protective layer. And so at the same time, it's responsible for things like shortwave communications, because it's charged long wavelengths, and various wavelengths can be bounced off of the ionosphere going around the curvature of the Earth so that they can be heard over great distances. So it acts as sort of a trap at the same time for radio frequency signals of a very specific type.
So what are the potential applications of HAARP and HAARP kind of technology?
Well, a couple of things is, when the sun is unstable, for instance, it disturbs the ionosphere and it disrupts global communications as an example. And so one of the thoughts was, if we could figure out a way to sort of artificially stabilize the ionosphere during these periods, we could facilitate global communications as an example, or conversely, disturb the ionosphere in such a way as to knock out all global communications except that of the operator, who would be able to carry his own communication signals on sort of the distortion. So as a weapons application, people can clearly kind of see the implications of shutting down communication systems across the planet. The other area that got a lot of attention was the idea of creating a intercontinental ballistic missile shield, and this was by accelerating electrons in a very specific way. With this instrument, you could, in fact, cause energy to flow sort of the opposite direction of the natural field lines that surround the Earth. There's magnetic field lines that people might remember from high school textbooks, where it was like the Earth was sort of a big magnet with a southern pole and a northern pole and field lines of magnetic force coming around the planet. The idea is that energy naturally runs south to north, and by injecting energy into these as waveguides, you could send energy from north to south so that any object passing through that sort of energy field that you stimulated would cause malfunctions on the things that control the aircraft flight path. So intercontinental ballistic missiles, as an example, would literally be destroyed in flight. So that kind of a shield was where really the big concepts of HAARP started, and then sort of the ancillary applications started coming up. Over-the-horizon radar, being able to create what's called an EMP or an electromagnetic pulse or surge of energy that deliberately knocks out a targeted aircraft over a fairly large area. Or things that get a little more exotic, the effects on human beings and biological systems as well as environmental systems starts to come into play with HAARP.
Is there any merit to the concept of using HAARP for mind control?
Actually, there is. It goes back to the work of J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who was a geophysicist at UCLA, and he was also a science advisor to President Johnson. And back in the 60s, he had written a paper that was later echoed by Zbigniew Brzezinski in one of his writings, a book called Between Two Ages, back when Brzezinski was at Columbia University in the early 70s. And the concept was that if we could ever figure out, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could return a signal back to the Earth that would manipulate the emotional state of those in contact with the signal. And the problem was, in 1969, when those words were written, there was no system for stimulating the ionosphere in that way. HARP does provide such a system, and work at, by Persinger at Laurentian University, as an example, in the mid-90s, talks about the idea of if you could just create this complex sort of waveform, which you can do, and broadcast it over a large area, well, you would create, say, a sense of dis-ease or discomfort within large segments of the population. And then you could do something as simple as a press release broadcast across the news airwaves, say, indicting some ethnic group or some set of circumstances for all your ills, which would turn a great deal of public sentiment and energy in a direction that otherwise we might not travel. Something as simple as that could be done in terms of emotional manipulation over large populations.
I was so stunned by that quote. You use it in one of your videos. I think it's the latest one on HARP.
Right.
And I kept replaying it and typed it all out, and I posted it up on the blog last week just because it was so, you know, it was such an extraordinary, the fact that it was in Brzezinski's book was so extraordinary to me.
Well, and I think that's been our hallmark. I mean, most who've read our work know that it's extraordinarily well footnoted.
Right.
And most of it is, you know, mainstream media or major academic reports, things people can actually get hold of. And I think that's important as you sort of take these issues in such a short amount of time today and sort of look at, okay, what do we do with these issues, you know, forward thinking, and how are they going to impact really the way we function now and in the future, not just big systems like HARP, but other systems that imply the same kinds of technologies.
Well, part of, you know, one of the things is even if, you know, what we've seen, if you're using these technologies for something else, but they impact the electromagnetic field, they can impact how people feel anyway.
Right.
I mean, it can be a side effect, not necessarily
right. The
goal of the system.
That's exactly right. And in many areas of science, you know, sort of unintended consequences by lack of coordination between the disciplines, which is pretty standard fare as we in the U.S. at least compartmentalize or deliberately separate our research initiatives, particularly in weapons applications.
What about weather modification?
This is a significant aspect of HARP, and initially, you know, it was one of those areas that shows up in the patents and people downplayed quite a bit. I had a very good relationship with Dr. Eastland, the inventor, up until his death in 2007. In fact, he participated in one of our conferences when I was executive director of the Lay Institute on mind effects and as it related to some of the issues with HARP. But on weather modification, Dr. Eastland had done some work for the European Space Agency after his work on HARP, on weather modification using HARP instruments, and then also for FEMA and NASA subsequent to that. And then in 2006, or it might have been 2005, he delivered a paper at the University of Pennsylvania on weather modification using HARP. And what he had concluded by 2006 was that you could modify weather with 1,600 times less energy than he originally expected when he wrote the HARP patents because of the ability of the system to manipulate what he referred to as gravitational waves that he felt underlie major developments in weather systems around the planet. So through that vehicle with much less power, he envisioned a system that could indeed manipulate huge systems of weather. And the thing about it is weather modification as a concept has actually been around a very long time, but the idea of using electrostatics or electromagnetic fields or radio frequency energy to stimulate weather modification really hasn't made it into the mainstream as often as some of the chemical means, although we've seen plenty of references to these breakthroughs in the technology.
one of the way this initially came up is when we were talking to Clifford Carnicom about global spraying. You know, there's an endless series of questions about what combines with what. And one of them was, of course, how does global spraying combine with HARP? Are they related? And if so, what's the goal?
Well, I have not seen enough to convince me that they are related, number one. You know, the possibilities are certainly there. I mean, the idea of creating a stimulated effect with certain chemical or metal constituents in the upper atmosphere, you know, can be, you know, effective with radio frequency energy to create other kinds of effects. For instance, if you put a toxic substance is relatively rare, into a limited area of the environment, and it's absorbed by living organisms like human beings, you could then target specific frequencies that are related to that chemical constituent, triggering poisoning in just the affected population, as an example. That kind of application could happen. With HARP, you really don't need anything to create the effects that are, you know, that we've spoken about in the course of time on the subject. And the other thing is with, in one particular instance, barium often comes up, and barium has been used in conjunction with the HARP system here in Alaska. We have the Poker Flats rocket range, and so they launched barium-laden rockets up into the ionosphere where the magnetic field lines sort of intersect, and then pumped controlled energy from the HARP system in a cyclotron resonance pattern, which creates sort of a corkscrewing kind of motion. And because of the barium and the electromagnetic fields, it literally lit up so you could actually see what the energy was doing physically, not just measuring it on instruments. You could actually see it in three dimensions, you know, up in the sky as it lit up.
Did it have a particular color?
Kind of a bluish color, very similar to what was seen over Northern Europe some months ago. And that was interesting enough, north of the Max Planck Institute, where one of the other ionospheric heaters operates in northern Norway. So very likely was associated or affiliated with that facility, in my opinion.
So the next question I was going to ask is the spread of this technology. Where, you know, where else are, you call them ionic, say that again, the thing about
ionospheric heaters is the way they used to refer to them. And they actually, the first ones go back to the Soviet Union as far as the public is concerned, and it was back in the 70s when the woodpecker signal was being reported by ham radio operators, which is kind of irritating signal.
So that was an a heater as well.
It was indeed. It was the early generation of the devices, and they were tracked down to five locations in the former Soviet Union. They were associated with things like disturbing mental function and weather modification, a whole lot of other things, knocking out the power grid in parts of Canada during that time. But then coming forward, the ISACAT system in Europe, there's a system of these across Canada that Rosalie Bertel has reported on. There is a Chinese transmitter now in the Antarctic, as we understand it. Russian Duma has passed resolutions opposing HARP, as has the European Parliament. Largely from the work that we've done and others with us have done in those areas, but primarily because they recognize the science and the risks associated with it have caused many governments to, you know, really pause on this one. And even Ben Eastland, the inventor, suggested if we were even going to go forward with the research, particularly in the weather modification area, this could not be done by military establishments. They just flat couldn't be trusted to do it safely and soundly. If it was ever to be done, in his view, it should have been done and should be done in the open light of day, multidisciplinary approaches, and a very, very slow approach, because the risks associated with this type of science are profound.
What are the environmental risks?
Well, you know, the idea of creating a runaway effect or an uncontrolled effect, I mean, the idea of stimulating geophysical events, whether they be weather modification, volcanic eruption, earthquake, you know, these kinds of things are actually discussed even by the past Secretary of Defense, William Cohen. He did that in a DOD news briefing after a conference on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, U.S. strategy. It was April 28, 97. And what he said is, he said others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely, through the use of electromagnetic waves, unquote. Now, what's important there is that attribution is to terrorist organizations, terrorist states having that level of science, which implies a couple of things. One is it's not that complicated, and two is it's probably off the shelf. And in terms of taking readily available components and constructing something that can create a signal that could trigger these kinds of events. And it's essentially, the theoretical idea is that it acts as sort of a primer, like a primer on a bullet. It stimulates energy that's already pent up or available, natural energy, in this case, energy along a fault line or energy in terms of magma, and then triggers a release of that energy in a directed way. And that's sort of the idea behind a lot of this new technology in this direction. And the thing about it is, you can totally wreck an economy with a natural disaster and have absolute plausible deniability in terms of overt conflict or an act of war. And that's where this technology gets a bit unnerving. And from my perspective, having researched in the area, all of the sophisticated governments of the world are pursuing this line of research, both for the idea of waging a clandestine war, which can easily be done then, but at the same time, you know, then you're sort of invited in to help clean up the mess. It's a pretty interesting approach to warfare, and one that I think we need to be highly cognizant of in this century.
Do you think the economics of this are such that literally a non-governmental party could create and operate such a site?
Yeah, I believe that is
correct.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is not something that requires billions of dollars in investment. I believe that that is entirely possible. In fact, a search of the web will reveal companies that provide right now commercial versions of weather modification that don't deal with cloud seeding. Now, the Russians have offered that on a number of occasions. Chinese have spoken about it openly. Some U.S. companies are even offering a service. There was a bill that was pending in the House and Senate some years ago, I don't believe it ever moved, but was to regulate weather modification technologies, primarily because of the advances in the private side. When you look at earthquake generation and those kinds of issues, I mean, obviously, firstly, you have to admit that it's possible, and then the restrictions come later. And I think, again, these are areas that there's open experimentation that's acknowledged within the literature, but there's no real cap, no real controls that I see at this moment. Although, having said it, to create these kinds of effects, you need a coherent, a rhythmic, obviously a man-made sort of signal that countries with the capability can also monitor the signal ranges wherein these kinds of effects could be created. And I think that's important as well.
Does anything in the HARP technology somehow dovetail with what's happening with Gwen towers or cell towers or any of those networks on the ground?
Well, they're, you know, you're dealing with different applications, again, of carriers. And here's the important thing, and this came out of the U.S. Army War College Quarterly Perimeters back, and I believe it was the winter of 98, and the article was called "The Mind Has No Firewalls." And what it basically said is any electromagnetic carrier can carry a signal that will manipulate behavior of those in contact with the signal, whether it's a TV broadcast, radio, even the computer internet, telephone lines, power grids. All of these can be modulated in a way that has a biological effect, has a direct coupling to the human system. With that said, one of the things that came out of Scottish media after the first Gulf conflict was the idea that perhaps we had used this kind of weapon to create fear on the part of the Iraqis. And if you remember, it was the fourth largest army in the world at the time in the early 90s.
And they just suddenly sat down and were shaking in terror, and everybody said, what happened?
Yeah, and what the Scottish media reported was through a project called SOLO, which we operate. It's kind of a propaganda machine in the air that does a lot of different things. But one of the things that it's reported to do is piggyback these kinds of signals, and they said they piggyback them into the radio stations that were broadcasting the Muslim music and prayer that all these guys were listening to, and then they put a signal on it that generated this sense of anxiety and fear. And so then when the bombardment started, there was this absolute emotional collapse on the part of the adversary. And from Scottish reports, and we speculate that was the case, but the Scottish reports found a way to confirm it. And You know, and that technology, the idea of agitating population, you know, pretty effective. Once we mixed in with the populations, you know, other systems could be used. But this idea of sort of a non-damaging way of to wage war, in the sense of physical damage to property and so on, can be mitigated if you have this kind of collapse within a population. But it also starts to raise, you know, deeper questions about where in fact, the lines are drawn in the realm of interference with people's awareness, consciousness, or mental functions.
Well, it's funny. My whole interpretation of the markets and where the markets have been and where they're going has very much been impacted by my assumptions about these kinds of invisible technologies. And it's really, I'll go back and tell you a story because I think it's very important for financial people to understand the possibilities here. In 2004, I was working with somebody who wanted a world bond fund, and I researched and finally found two that I could live with. And one of them, and they made a sizable investment. This was in the end of 2004. And one of them had 15% of their investments in Indonesian sovereign debt. And right after they bought it, it dropped 15% overnight on huge insider trading. Just, you know, people on the inside selling. And there was no change in the market. There was no logical reason for this to happen. I couldn't figure out. The sponsor, which is a very reputable company, wouldn't answer our calls, wouldn't answer the questions. It was baffling. And then a week later, the tsunami happened.
Right, right.
And I've never been.
Well, and this possibility has been.
Right, and what we saw was a pattern of people being ready to exploit it. Now, I've seen other things like that. On 9/11, we saw patterns of, you know, financial and investment patterns both before, during, and after that would lead you to believe that people were trading it and had knowledge ahead of time, which would be logical. It had to be planned out. But we were watching, as Naomi Klein says, this whole growth of disaster capitalism, and behind much of it, you got the feeling that there were these invisible technologies, whether it was, you know, much more powerful surveillance or literally the ability to induce, you know, weather changes and things that look like natural disasters, as Secretary Cohen said.
Well, it, you know, all of that is, again, in today's world, these possibilities do exist, and I think a part of it, too, is sort of this mindset of disaster planning by sophisticated traders. As soon as they see the implications, they immediately begin the activity of the trade. The question becomes is, did they kick off the event? And in some cases, that question's a fair one to ask. And here's the problem. Without independent global monitoring of the kinds of signals that can create these effects, which requires a much different approach to the technology, it has to be removed from the realm of military science and moved into the realm of civilian science so we can ask these kinds of questions.
Right, and redundant civilian science.
Absolutely, because
right.
Here's what's happened. When we testified in the European Parliament, we were brought over by the Foreign Affairs Chairman on a number of occasions for various events, and at one point we were able to come into a hearing and testify on not just the HAARP systems, but other non-lethal weapon systems that have implications on personal privacy and some of the deeper implications of mental interference. And we brought that forward. It made it into their most comprehensive security and disarmament resolution as one of the areas that requires a whole lot more review. And I think that sort of direction of not just review, but treaty dialogue to forbid the uses of these kinds of weapon systems. In fact, the idea of manipulating human beings, the resolution actually calls for that kind of dialogue for the purpose of limiting the expansions in this area. I mean, people who know what it's like to have civil liberties destroyed, totally removed, as in the case of Eastern Europeans particularly, but within their living memory, has much different implications and impact on that population than the same issues do in the United States. We just sort of take our freedoms for granted, and I think in recent years we've seen the erosion of that at a rate where now the American public is starting to ask the kinds of questions that maybe we're a decade late on, but you know, better late than never. In Americans, I think we always rise to the occasion, usually about 5 minutes before midnight. It's just our nature. I mean,
we're at about 6 minutes before midnight.
Yeah, we're getting close. And so, you know, really is time, not just these issues, but the implications of these technologies. When you think about financial markets and the economy, you think about what's happening in the Gulf right now is another example of how quickly things can change from one event. And the full implications
right.
of that event have yet to be recognized. And I say that sincerely in terms of not just the immediate damage to the environment and the long-term damage, but how people will view offshore oil drilling in the future and how people will view that industry is profoundly changed forever. And unfortunately, we didn't get the early warning. You know, when it happened here in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez, we're so remote, even though the media covered it and everything. It's a whole different thing when a few tens of thousands of people experience something like this versus the millions that are impacted in the Gulf region and then now up on the as we move on up on the East Coast as this stuff moves forward.
Right, and it's quite phenomenal. If you look at what the risk BP took to make another dollar, or somebody took to make another
yeah.
dollar versus the ecosystem harm,
right.
Even if you want to try and express it in dollar terms, it's extraordinary. So. The fact that one private party could bring, or a few private parties
yep.
could bring that much damage to life and to the economy is pretty amazing.
Well, and what needs to be recognized is these aren't quick fixes. You know, they're going to go away at some point, and the damage is going to be done. It's going to take many years to recover. And the full culpability of all of that is not there. The full economic responsibility is not there. And, you know, British Petroleum had a policy, and I think we'll see more of this come out as the media goes on, about sort of don't fix it till it breaks. And that attitude, because of the value of oil and gas, leads to problems that potentially are going to emerge here in Alaska again. You know, the pipeline now is 33 years old. It's operated since 1977. It is a sulfuric base. You know, there is sulfur within the oil, and it creates sulfuric acid. And this gradually erodes the interior of the pipe. And you know, they've been replacing huge sections of it. But the risk by waiting till the last moments to do that are extreme. And we've had some minor spills, some a little greater. In the operating field that BP operates. You know, BP operates the Prudhoe Bay oil field,
right.
largest oil and gas field in North
right.
America. And people need to remember that their level of responsibility here in Alaska it parallels what's happened in the Gulf. The only difference is scale at the moment because we haven't had the failure in the unreachable spot. But nonetheless, these risks exist. And a sharing of that risk is only proportional to the shared revenue stream. And on the public resource of oil and gas, the oil industry has the advantage and they need to absorb the risk. And the proper levels of insuring that risk need to be borne by them.
Right. The one difference I will say, because Alaska was smarter, is that everybody in Alaska gets a dividend check on the oil, whereas nobody in Louisiana and Alabama really
right.
do.
Well, and here's the thing, too, is as it goes to the economy, you know, Alaska has no income tax at the state level for individuals, and at the corporate level doesn't start till you net a quarter of a million. We do receive distribution out of the oil revenues that comes to every citizen every year, and last year it was around $1,300. The year before it was around $3,200. Doesn't really make up for a lot of the cost of living here. I can tell you
Absolutely.
In Bush, Alaska, diesel fuel in the bush is $10 a gallon, and a gallon of milk is about the same. So you got to put it all in perspective, but it is a different way of engaging in a sharing of the public resource, certainly, and one that has proven to be a very effective model for keeping the population fully engaged in oil and gas policy.
Right. They pay attention to policy in Alaska in ways they don't. In my experience in Louisiana,
that's right. We all have a vested interest, and it's a small enough population where we can assert that interest.
One more point on the economy. One of the things we watched when you know, it's kind of like the world went crazy as soon as we adopted the Uruguay round of GATT, And what we started to see was much longer lines on investment. A lot more money was being moved abroad. And the history of investment is one where we don't move money to a place where we can't enforce.
Right.
The money only flows where the enforcement flows. And as you watch sort of the development of GATT and NAFTA, you think, you know, these guys suddenly got a lot more surveillance and invisible weaponry that would let them think they could do this. And, you know, and I think there's some relationship there that we don't understand that needs to be understood. Because if you look at our ability to implement the strong dollar policy, it has depended on literally forcing sovereign nations and institutions globally to take securities and currencies that are falling in value steadily.
Well, I agree with a lot of that. I think the ability to influence leadership, particularly targeting leadership, this is why the European Parliament got so excited about the mind effects technology. Is, you know, anyone who understands social change recognizes the first place you try and do your co-option is at the leadership level, and generally countries sort of follow. That's it, relatively easy with today's technology to disrupt the mental processes of national leaders in a targeted way. It's there now. We have that technology. We have that capability. Being able to influence public policy with other governments, you know, we've got a long history in this country of interference, overt interference and covert interference. These new technologies give it a whole new dimension, and that's where and we see it. It's not just the United States. So Russians, Chinese, everyone
right.
is engaged in research in this area, and it's sort of who gets there first, and you know, can they get away with it? And I think this issue will become increasingly one of the most important issues of the century. One of the other areas will, under the military guise, is what's called controlled effects, creating complete memory sets that are impossible to distinguish the synthetic from the real under the guise of training techniques and training programs for like language and certain skill sets. But at the same time, you know, it starts to ask questions, you know, what about court hearings in the future if you can't distinguish a real memory from a false one? What does that do to trials in 20 years or 30 years?
Right, it's because I've just finished in 2006, you know, years of intense litigation, and as I studied these technologies, I said, well, I'm glad I got that over with.
Well, and you know, the thing about it is there's compelling commercial interests these days as well as governmental interests and, you know, lots of special interests that have a strong desire to move public opinion and policy in certain ways. And so the temptation is really the question. You know, are people tempted enough to use it and if they can get away with it? And I would suggest the answer to that is a resounding yes, as history has generally shown.
Well, that's why the idea of creating a redundant civilian monitoring capacity in multiple locations is very attractive.
Yeah, and the thing about these technologies, and this is important to note as well, is they leave a footprint. They leave a signature, an electromagnetic footprint. If you understand the technology enough to develop them, you can also detect them pretty readily out of the background noise of all of the clutter of electromagnetic fields and the various sources for them. You can do this, and the amount of energy needed to influence behavior is also quite small. It's really frequency, pulse rate, waveform, and other criteria dependent, all of which can be observed if you have the right monitoring equipment and you're geared for it. And that's where, again, I think it's important as we move forward and sort of look at the implications of our technology that we understand also the implications for free markets and liberty and freedom at its fundamental level.
You know, with this kind of technology, when some players have it and some don't, I don't see how you have markets.
No, then you have just a pure gaming of the system, and that's the big concern as well. And when you look at other privacy-related technologies, and I'm sure you've covered them from time to time on your program, as you start to integrate those technologies, look at them as complete systems of control, you recognize exactly how transparent individuals become and then how easily manipulated. Because what will happen as media and the ability to target individual consumers increases, the messaging that is tailored specifically for you based on data valence technologies and a pure sort of statistical model that runs over millions and millions of people to talk about and sort of target you with sort of your likes and dislikes in a way that is very compelling. Think about political advertising of the future, where maybe the candidate has 100 messages and he figures out which three you agree with. And
right.
all of the messaging you receive from that point forward are those three issues. The other 97% of his agenda, you know, you'd burn him at the stake in the parking lot, but here you are voting for the guy because of tailored messaging. And that's, it doesn't just deal with the politician, you know, but consumer products or general public opinion, all of which can start to be moved by greater understandings of how to move media and then how to influence people on this more direct access method.
Now, one of the things I've always believed is you can't have an intelligent conversation about climate or climate change without talking about what in the world's going on with HAARP and global spraying and a variety of these invisible technologies. And I noticed that you've addressed that. Maybe if you could say a minute or two on that subject.
Well, on the climate change issue, I'm a contrarian in terms of the causes, although I don't take exception to the idea that human beings are impacting the environment. You know, I mean, the idea that we're the big cause of climate change, I don't believe that's the case. I think it's a natural cycle. Man contributes 1 to 3% of gases responsible for climate variances in nature, produces the rest in varying amplitudes of output. And so nature does have these big cycles. Man, however, now at a time when these systems are obviously stressed and resulting in major changes across the planet, we're manipulating these additional factors. And so I look at it as sort of the straw on the camel's back. These other systems are becoming much more sophisticated and capable of causing these massive problems. On the other hand, the smokestack issues, I consider the chemical constituents in those smokestack emissions from the developing world as a greater problem in what they're doing to the genetic blueprint of the planet. And I would cite Nicholson and Colburn's work at MIT on that subject. But it really is a big problem. The global warming is a natural cycle. And this is where I think we need to be a little more vigilant, is recognizing that we're not going to reverse it. I mean, even if you hold man responsible and you stop every emission there is, which is not going to happen, it would take 100 years to reach an equilibrium according to some of the models that I've seen. Having said that, then we have to look at it a little differently. As we can argue about the cause till we're dead of the event, or we can start recognizing global changes here. And because of its implications and the changes in food production patterns, countries need to pay attention because it is going to change. It's going to radically alter food production on the planet, which leads to social and other instabilities. And we need to be cognizant of it and recognize that pattern as not something that can be avoided in the short run and needs to be addressed.
Now, how do we protect ourselves from electromagnetic interference, whether it's HAARP or any of the other sources?
Well, and this is this is not an easy an answer, because you'd need full spectrum analyzers to first of all determine what's coming at you, and then you'd need to develop countermeasures for each of them. And there is no real economic way for the average person to accomplish that. The one thing I will say is that strong systems, including yourself, tend to lock on to the more powerful signals in your vicinity. So some you'll ignore. Even in the best research I've read, they say in these mass systems, only about 70% of the population is affected, which implies to me that part of it is from sort of where you're sitting. You might create some sort of cancellation effect, or you have a more strong field effect. And that would explain that. I think the real solutions in terms of protecting oneself deal with the idea of delving into the science deeply enough to understand a little bit about it, and then making sure that we're relaying that information on to policymakers that can actually regulate the science. And that's where I think ultimately this has to go. It's not going to happen on an individual basis driven by fear. It's going to happen on a recognition of the state of technology and the recognition of what civil people need to do to maintain the integrity of liberty within our republics.
Right, I agree. And part of it is simply is getting everyone to the point where we can just have an open conversation without fear about this.
Yeah, and I think that's starting to get there. I mean, we put together a conference, the Lay Institute, and brought in major scientists a few years ago. That was useful in getting some dialogue moving in a direction. We're seeing more in the open literature on the subject, which is helpful. The book that I wrote, Controlling the Human Mind, has, I think, 250 reference sources on the early technology, as well as the flip side, sort of what we can do to enhance our human capacity, given what we're learning about the brain and about consciousness itself. And to me, that is the greatest challenge. People say, what can we do? That's exactly where we start. It's
we develop our own mind.
Exactly right. And I think there are now technologies that can open the possibility of not just higher states of consciousness, awareness, and capacity, what the military now refers to as anomalous human capabilities, another area of research. And this really deals with sort of the that unknown dimension of the human mind and consciousness and what it may, in fact, offer humanity now and in the future. In fact, many of the people that I've spoken to on this subject believe that the next evolution of humankind is stepping into sort of these higher attributes. And when you look at the research on mind control that we've done as it relates to the government, the other side of this is what they learned human beings could do. And I think this generated more fear in government circles than anything.
I absolutely agree with you. The more you study these kinds of technologies, the more you realize they're just saying, holy cow, people are really powerful.
And here's what happened as a result. You know, you think I was saying about some of the directions in which it's going. The one thing that dampens the ability of a human being to reach these higher states of consciousness, the one thing that works every time is fear. If you look at an EEG and look at the brain activity of a person experiencing fear, you'll see nothing but incoherent brain patterns, the kind that do
really?
Not lend themselves to any creative or intellectual higher order thinking. If you're devoid of fear and you can maintain that steady state and slow the mind into those alpha rhythms or high theta rhythms where real creative action takes place and you're sort of in that zone, and some of the more exceptional, extraordinary things take place, it requires a state of non-fear, a state of awareness, a state of calm, rhythmic breathing, certain things that you can actually do to put yourself there, that all of the economic fears, the fears of war, famine, frustration, such an easy tool to turn off human consciousness in a way that forbids us and totally manipulates us from reaching a better place.
It's very interesting. One of the places that you'll see the sort of the powers that be really get stopped are things that relate to people's children. So homeschooling, vaccines, now we're seeing the whole food freedom.
Right.
And it's really, as Franklin Sanders would say, where mama decides, no, I'm not putting up with this. And that's when people become fearless.
Yeah, and we should be.
Yeah.
We should be, because we, as individuals, every one of us, has the capability of changing everything around us by just stepping into what we can do, not what we can't do. And I think the real message in concluding a little bit tonight is the idea that, you know, all of us have a sphere of influence. You know, you have yours, I have mine, but every listener has theirs, whether it's your family,
right,
friends, or others. And we just need to step into that, start acting on what we believe to be right and true, whether it's these issues or others, and doing something constructively to change the way we see and others might see the world. If we do a little bit of that without relying on some formal group to form to make that happen, a lot gets done, believe me. And we followed that philosophy the last 15 years and have walked
in a lot of
places.
It's amazing what you've accomplished.
And we never would have done it without what people consider insignificant events. I mean, those, there are none. They're all significant. They all matter. We just need to keep doing them. And that's the answer.
Now, with that, tell us how we can keep up with you and support your work.
Sure. We have a website, earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSE, earthpulse.com. And we have a sign up. We don't send a lot of things out, but every once in a while we'll send a note out about what we're following or things that we're looking into that we think are important. But there's a lot of articles. There's a lot of audio material there and other material that's free. And, of course, to stay in this work, we always appreciate it when you get our books and videos. And when you're done with them, send them to your U.S. congressman and your U.S. senator. Maybe someone will look at them, and maybe we will change the way things roll.
Oh, we will. We will. It's coming. Well, I can't thank you enough. You've been very generous with your time. We have gobs of more questions, and I hope I can get you back because this is an ongoing conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me, and my best to your entire listening audience. And we wish you well, and we'll look forward to doing it again in the future.
Great. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this week. Coming up next week, we have, the week after next, first week in August, we have Charles Murray, who's the president of the American Institute of Economic Research, a wonderful organization. I'm a member. We're going to talk about how you can use their materials for your financial planning needs, and we're going to focus on one of their more marvelous booklets called, If Something Should Happen, How to Organize Your Financial and Legal Affairs. It's a workbook, very useful for sort of getting your financial house in order. And then the following week, Precious Metals, we have a buildup of great precious metals questions that we're going to be going through. Franklin Sanders and I, in addition to the questions in the Precious Metals Market Report, want to talk about the development of local economies and why we think silver and gold can play such an important role in rebuilding local economies. Again, I just want to remind you a great two-page handout on the identity theft conversation we had last week with Bob Selvin. Some great quick ideas of things you can do to protect yourself against identity theft. It's one of the financial planning or financial risks I'm really concerned about for all of us, so I would really encourage you to take a look and just make a few simple changes to help you protect yourself. So until then, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.